What do Bob Ewell from To Kill a Mockingbird and the stars of Duck Dynasty have in common? Both represent America's most enduring contradiction, a nation built on equality that has always maintained a rigid class system. When Harper Lee's classic hit theaters in 1962, audiences embraced its message of racial justice while overlooking another disturbing portrayal, the Ewells as irredeemable white trash living behind the town dump. Fast forward to 2012, and 11.8 million Americans tuned in to watch Duck Dynasty, our modern fascination with the same stereotypes packaged as entertainment. This isn't coincidence. It's evidence of a class consciousness we've never acknowledged. From colonial Virginia to reality television, America has always had a bottom rung, and we've always needed someone to occupy it. America wasn't founded as a land of opportunity. It was designed as England's dumping ground. Colonial literature painted America as both a fertile virgin bride and a convenient place to thin out prisons. These waste people were expendable labor, sent to serve English interests and expected to perish. By 1662, Virginia law defined slave status through condition of the mother, applying livestock breeding concepts to human reproduction. Slave women's fertility became commercial property, their children listed in wills as breedings with future increase, the exact language used for cattle. Royal surveyors ensured large planters claimed the best land first, while slave shipments went to major landholding families. By 1700, indentured servants had virtually no chance of land ownership, forced to move elsewhere or become permanent tenants. The harsh mathematics were simple. Waste people fertilized the soil with their labor while finding it impossible to harvest any social mobility. This pattern would echo through centuries. The poorest whites remained trapped at the bottom, their expendability built into the system from day one. James Oglethorpe founded Georgia in 1733 as a haven for England's worthy poor, opposing slavery because it would promote the misery of thousands in Africa. He compared enslaved Africans to English sailors, essentially treated as slaves, dragged off streets, and sold into the Navy. Pro-slavery settlers argued Africans were bred up for swamp labor and heat, requiring minimal provisions, while white servants demanded English dress, meat, bread, and beer. Without these comforts, whites became feeble and fled Georgia as if escaping a charnel house. The deeper problem? Many settlers lacked farming experience. Georgia had too many apothecaries and tinkers, too few who could cultivate soil. Oglethorpe restricted slavery primarily to prevent it from starving the poor white laborer and concentrating class power. When he left in 1743, his experiment collapsed. By 1750, slavery was legalized and a planter elite quickly formed. Jonathan Bryan amassed 32,000 acres and 250 slaves, while only 5% of white Georgians owned even a single slave, precisely the concentration of wealth Oglethorpe had warned against. Benjamin Franklin approached class with scientific detachment, studying ants and pigeons to conclude humans were driven by instincts to eat, procreate, and move. His 1751 treatise, Observations Concerning the Increase of Mankind, predicted Americans would double in population every 20 years through large families encouraging industry. His satirical Speech of Miss Polly Baker defended an unwed mother fulfilling the first and great command of nature, increase and multiply. Franklin valued reproductive labor as imperial asset building, defending bastards, including his son William, as population contributors. Yet Franklin's theory contradicted Philadelphia's reality of poverty and high infant mortality. His own success depended on Quaker patrons and political connections, not simple industry. He believed the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but leading or driving them out of it. His demographic theory contained harsh reality. The frontier would force settlers to work hard or perish, with only the frugal, fertile, and industrious succeeding. This wasn't opportunity, but a brutal sorting mechanism. Thomas Jefferson championed equality while operating within Virginia's rigid hierarchy of land, slaves, and tobacco. Though praising cultivators of the earth as virtuous, he was a gentleman farmer, relying on slaves and hired labor. His reforms reinforced class divisions. His workhouse bill passed while education reform failed, punishing vagabonds and forcing their children into apprenticeships. His phrase, raked from the rubbish, revealed his philosophy, turning over barren social soil to unearth potential, gradually improving the crop of citizens. Jefferson's breeding metaphors weren't merely rhetorical. In Notes on the State of Virginia, he questioned why superior beauty shouldn't guide human propagation as it did for horses. He calculated that a black slave could become white after 7/8 white blood, the same formula for breeding Merino sheep. Jefferson fathered children with his quadri slave Sally Hemings, whose offspring were the fourth cross, making them candidates for passing as white. He coldly termed slave children increase, valuing female slaves more because a child raised every 2 years is of more profit than the crop of the best laboring man. The architect of American equality calculated human breeding value like livestock. By the 1970s, white trash evolved from insult to identity. As middle-class life signaled inauthenticity, some reclaimed poor backgrounds as authentic heritage. The 1972 film Deliverance seared backwoods imagery into national consciousness, while country music and Hollywood embraced redneck chic. Dolly Parton even appeared in Vogue. This commercialization sanitized class reality. NASCAR celebrated drivers like Junior Johnson, transformed from whiskey runner to wealthy racer, as raw and hillbilly. By 2008, reality television exploded with white trash tropes. Swamp People, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, Duck Dynasty. When Mama June Shannon became the new face of white trash, her show was canceled after dating a convicted child molester. Sarah Palin's candidacy revealed political limits. Staffers called her family Wasilla Hillbillies Looting Neiman Marcus. Unlike Bill Clinton, who offset white trash origins with Rhodes Scholar credentials, Palin couldn't escape the label. America would embrace white trash as entertainment, but remained deeply ambivalent about giving them real power. Two lies poison American democracy: the myth of exceptionalism and the denial of class. We measure human worth by land value and zip code, determining access to schools, safe neighborhoods, and infrastructure. America transfers wealth through bloodlines more rigidly than modern European nations. Americans pass on 50% of their wealth to children, compared to just 15% in Denmark. The best predictor of success remains your forebears' class status, not your work ethic or talent. From colonial times through today, the white poor have been renamed but never disappeared. Waste people, crackers, lubbers, hillbillies, rednecks, trailer trash. Billy Redden, the banjo player from Deliverance, now works at Walmart, struggling really hard to make ends meet 40 years after the film. The persistence of class challenges our most cherished myths. We've never been a classless society, and the American dream has always been more accessible to some than others. Until we acknowledge that some Americans have been systematically kept at the bottom since colonial times, we can't begin dismantling the mechanisms that keep them there.